You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Dr. Boz Dreisinger wears many hats. She's an associate professor of English at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York, my dad's alma mater. She's also a journalist, justice worker, film and radio producer, and cultural critic and prison rights activists. She's the founder and academic director of the Prison to College Pipeline, which I hope you'll hear about more about tonight. She's produced on-air segments about music and global culture for NPR and has co-produced and written documentaries such as Black and Blue, Legends of the Hip-Hop Cop, which investigates the New York Police Department's monitoring of the hip-hop industry, and Rhyme and Punishment about hip-hop and the prison industrial complex. She's the author of Near Black, White to Black, Passing in American Culture, which was in 2008. And her most recent and very necessary book, which she'll be discussing tonight with Scott, is Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. For her ambitious new book, Dr. Dreisinger undertakes a pilgrimage to prisons in 9 different countries around the world. She considers the very nature of punishment and the idea of restorative justice, and she does so with honesty, courage, and humility. Years ago in this same room, we welcomed to the stage Phumla Gobodo Madikizela, the only psychologist on South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In her talk about reconciliation, she explained what an apology must contain in order for its words to what she called perform. She reminded us that the apology must be unconditional, that victims hold a particular power in the dynamic. They can give or deny forgiveness. They hold the key to what the perpetrator so desires to rejoin the realm of moral humanity. And she pointed to the old adage, "The truth shall set you free." Dr. Dreisinger bears witness to how restorative justice works among genocide survivors in Rwanda, in a creative writing class in an overcrowded Ugandan prison. She delves into the modern prison system as a U.S. export, explaining how the origins of our own democracy were tied up with the birth of the very idea of the prison. And she asks us to consider the vast human potential locked away in our own country's obscenely bloated penal system and ways in which, yes, the truth might set so many free. In discussion with Dr. Dreisinger tonight, I couldn't be more pleased to introduce Scott Budnick, founder and president of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. Until recently, Scott worked in the film industry. He executive produced the Hangover movies, the top-grossing R-rated comedy franchise in history. But outside of film, he's a fierce champion for children in need. You may have read the profile on him in the California Sunday Magazine about how in 2014 he became a full-time activist. The Anti-Recidivism Coalition, the support and advocacy nonprofit he had begun in his garage, now has a $1.2 million budget, a paid staff of 6, and an office close to this very library. Scott teaches and serves on the board for Inside Out Writers, an organization that aims to reduce juvenile recidivism through the use of creative writing and by providing a range of services to formerly incarcerated young adults. And I might add that at dinner tonight at Cafe Pino for our authors, Scott received a call from Pelican Bay on his cell phone, which was probably the only call from Pelican Bay ever received at Cafe Pino, I'm pretty sure. He was recently selected to be a board member of President Obama's newly created foundation, My Brother's Keeper Alliance. I think you're going to have a very interesting evening ahead of you. Please welcome Dr. Boz Dreisinger and Scott Budnick.
Good evening. The thing about curiosity is that if you dwell on it for too long, it can lose its force. I felt this happening working in the prison system. Some of prison's bizarreness had begun to wear off. I was so routinely there and so often immersed in analyzing prison issues, I worried that my thinking had grown stale and that I was beginning to lose perspective. During one conversation with a funder, I caught myself using the words at home to describe how I felt in the classroom at Otisville Correctional Facility. This appalled me. Did I really feel at home in a place once so alien to me? I decided I needed a shock to the system, to unseat basic truths, to ask myself what I used to get asked all the time before my world became overwhelmingly filled with people who shared my passions and premises. Why care so passionately about the so-called wrongdoers of the world? The plan unfolded in my mind's eye. I would find fresh answers to this question globally, seeing prison anew by seeing it around the world, and seeing the world by seeing its prisons. Invoking Dostoevsky, Nelson Mandela famously said that no one truly knows a nation until one has been inside its jails. A nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but its lowest ones. The journey would be a chance to rethink one of America's most impactful national experiments and global exports. Between 2008 and 2011, the prison population grew in 78% of all countries. Some 10.3 million people worldwide are behind bars, many convicted of nothing, waiting years to be tried, and lacking access to adequate legal assistance. Yet the public conversation rarely seemed to turn from America's incarceration crisis to the global prison problem, something the United States built and then foisted on the world. Justice should be loud and proud, a transparent system endorsed by all citizens. Yet prisons, the crown jewel of today's international justice system, are anything but transparent. They're invisible spaces, places most never see yet dimly accept as real and right. And how could anyone endorse what cannot be seen? On a very basic level, I felt an urge to expose the hidden places and forgotten people that exist in every country across the globe. I hope to be a witness in the world and make my readers witnesses too. Such a journey seemed, for myself and my readers, a moral imperative. From the get-go, I envisioned a trek through human stories, human stories. The language of corrections turns prisons into clinical, sterile spaces, carceral places, quote, correctional facilities, or behavioral management units filled with, quote, unquote, inmates and offenders serving sentences under wardens. Such language makes it easy to forget that there is nothing facile about a facility, that inside these prisons, day in and day out, for years, for decades, for life, are living, breathing human beings. I wanted myself and others to lay eyes on them, to not look away, just as we could not look away during the crises at Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo, those rare moments when our nation's oubliettes, to borrow a 14th century French term for prison dungeons, it means forgotten ones, violently pried their way into public view, demanding that we confront the human detritus of our justice system. I selected 9 countries that might revolve around themes that defamiliarize foundational concepts about justice and prison, concepts we too often take for granted. After all, at panels and rallies and newspaper editorials and exposés, I heard plenty of calls for reform, many of them driven by arguments about economics and public safety. These are vital reasons, but what about fundamental moral arguments about prison as an ethical concept? Where were these in the public discourse? It was time to go back to the theoretical drawing board. I would re-ask the big questions about punishment, redemption, forgiveness, and second chances that had made me a prison activist to begin with, and see if I might convert others not just into caring about such questions, but as voting, thinking citizens of a democracy, into becoming potential agents of change too. Perhaps I can make my zealous curiosity contagious for the greater good. First stop, Rwanda.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for writing this spectacular book and shining a light on people who are mostly invisible behind prison walls and bringing this to light. I thought it would be helpful for the audience here. I knew when I started in this in 2004 and walked into a juvenile hall for my first time, I did not know anything about this issue and really needed to kind of set the table so I knew what I was walking into. So if you don't mind, as we begin to travel around the world and see incredible practices, both good and atrocious from other countries. Could you set the table a little bit in terms of what our system looks like in the United States right now?
So our system is basically a bloated mess, a bloated, utterly expensive mess. We have 2.3 million people incarcerated in prisons and jails in this country. We're spending over $50 billion in corrections to some estimates, and that might even be a low estimate. Some estimate it higher. In various states, we're spending at least 10 times more to incarcerate someone than educate that person. There are enormous racial disparities in the criminal justice system on every level, but we know that in terms of the prison system, there are more people under correctional supervision. There are more African Americans under correctional supervision today than there were slaves at the height of slavery in 1850. So we're talking about really obscene high numbers. And the other thing to know is that America is, of course, the world's biggest jailer. We have the most people in prison. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population.
And I think putting it into a California perspective, as we have taxpayers and voters and parishioners in this room, 60,000 in California to incarcerate one adult, 230,000 a year to incarcerate one child. Four times the cost of Stanford. You could send a child to Stanford for 4 years, what it costs to incarcerate them for 1 year, and the recidivism rate is 70%. So we spend that amount of money. The system's about a $10 billion system. We spend more on prisons than we do on higher education in California, and we fail 7 out of 10 times. So you start seeing Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist and Rand Paul and even Ted Cruz start talking about how screwed up this system is. And then you start looking at the economic cost. You start looking at the human cost.
And the moral cost.
And the moral cost. And what would the cost be if you actually worked to turn this child's life around at 16, this child's life around at 18, and put them into a rehabilitative environment to stop a lifetime of criminality, rather than send them into a correctional facility with prison guards that just keep punishing them?
We also have, I mean, it's also worthwhile to think again globally. We also have some of the longest sentences in the world. We're inimitable in our delivering of life sentences and of very lengthy sentences. There are over almost 200,000 people in this country serving life sentences. There are about 20 people in the UK serving life sentences, and we're actually one of only 9 countries to punish via both the death penalty, having both the death penalty and life in prison. So all of this is quite dramatic.
So as we begin talking about the countries you visited, what drew you to these countries? Of everything you could have chosen, why this group here? Why this tour?
So every prison system is both fascinating and worth knowing about. What I did was choose countries that were kind of representative of particular issues that I wanted to explore. Because I wanted to, as I was reading from that piece from the introduction, a big part of what I wanted to do was step back and think about the fundamental issues at stake when we think about criminal justice issues, when we think about prisons. And so I selected Rwanda and South Africa to think about forgiveness, to think about this paradigm, the concept of punishment as an ethical issue, the role of restorative justice, and thinking about alternative paradigms that might focus on reparations and restitution instead of revenge and harm. I chose Uganda and Jamaica because I wanted to think about the arts in prisons. And so I ultimately started an arts program in Uganda and witnessed one, a reggae music program in Jamaica. I looked at women in Thailand because there's an extraordinarily high percentage of incarcerated women in Thailand, and because one of the princesses of Thailand is quite invested in changing that.
And by the way, women, the fastest growing prison population in California right now is are women.
And actually, that's true globally. They're the fastest prison growing prison population in the world. And the Princess of Thailand has started an organization to create kind of quote-unquote model prisons and change this and make an impact. So I went to work with her organization. I went to Brazil to look at solitary confinement because of its recent investment in the federal supermax model that we invented over here on our shores. And I went to Australia to think about privatization and the role of capitalism and the prison industrial complex, because Australia has the highest number of people in private prisons per capita in the world. I went to Singapore to look at its unique and sometimes very effective approach to reentry. And then I went to Norway because it's Norway, and everyone who, everyone who thinks about justice and not even specifically related to prisons, but an equitable society is generally pretty focused on Norway. So I ended there because I wanted to see if Norway sort of lives up to all of those, all the hype and expectation. I think we'll get there, right?
Yeah, we'll definitely get there. Don't worry, we'll cover that. Yeah. What do you think, as you kind of look back to your couple-year journey, what were the moments that you witnessed in any piece of it that really pointed out to you what an outlier we are in the United States?
So there were so many. I think it's an incredible thing to be in. You know, I mean, the question that I get asked the most is, okay, what's the worst and what's the best? And it's a question I refuse to answer because, number one, I don't quantify pain, and prison is pain any which way you slice it, even in Norway, as we'll get to. And also pain is relative, and prisons are, that Mandela quote is spot on. They really are reflections of society. So everything is sort of relative. But I will say that I've been in, you know, the most insanity producing solitary confinement prison in Brazil. And I've had men shout at me, "I can't believe you still have the death penalty in your country." And I've been in a hideously violent Polesmoor prison in South Africa, notorious. It's the largest prison in Africa. It's notorious for its gang violence. And I've had people shout at me, "I can't believe you have life sentences in your country. What?" So it's a really, really amazing thing to be in some of these places, these global hellholes, and have people look at me and say, tell Obama he needs to get this together because this is not working. When I'm so, you know, and that was definitely one of them. And I think too, witnessing the other thing that was really, really jarring is that prisons are, and I gloss over this in the piece I just read, but prisons are essentially an American invention. We invented the modern prison system, and then via colonialism and then globalization, we exported it to the world. And so there is nothing like the feeling of turning up in, you know, the boonies of Rwanda in the countryside, and there is a prison structure that looks like it could come from upstate New York. Or being in Brazil and seeing and, you know, driving up to a supermax that looks like it belongs in California. So to see the way that this system has been copycatted and foisted, like down to the prison architecture, down to the vocabulary that's used, and to really witness that, that's when you really start to feel like, what are we doing? This is not only is it a case of American, you know, superiorism at play, but it's just flat out laziness, that it's just one copycatting imitation after another.
Who do you think the most inspiring person that you met on the entire journey? Who can't you get out of your mind?
Probably, I would say it's a student in Uganda. I started a creative writing program. And Uganda, I got into the prison system literally by the back door through a hole in the gate. I never got permission by the officials to go there. I connected with an NGO, and I went there specifically because I was really impressed with what I'd read about this NGO that's trying to make a dent in a prison system that's at 250% capacity, where people are sleeping standing up, where there's the TB rate, the transmission of TB rate is inordinately high. There's no mental health services. There's nothing. And there was something called the African Prison Project that was trying to do some interesting work there. And so I came there, and it ended up, they said, "Well, why don't you start this creative writing workshop? You can train people in the prisons to do to lead the workshop after you leave." And so one of the people in there, his name is Wilson, who became a major character in the book, really I watched his life change in the course of engaging in this work. And I got to know him very well. And then when he came out of prison, a friend of mine in Uganda actually helped him find a home. And he called himself Pastor. He had transformed himself into a pastor in the context of prison. And now, actually, I just recently got an email from him where he was telling me he read the book and he loved it. I had a copy sent to him, of course. And I think he stays with me the most because that is evidence of, I don't even want to say transformation, but survival, the capacity to survive and the capacity to find hope. Because I don't want to say either rehabilitation, because he shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. He was there because he couldn't afford the bribe to get out. Like pretty much everyone else in the system. It's a system that criminalizes poverty. So Wilson definitely...
That's called bail here. Me.
Yeah, exactly. Or the expensive lawyer that you can or cannot buy.
Yeah. I would never be sitting in jail awaiting trial in a million years.
But, correct.
And in juvenile hall where I do most of my work, I think in 14 years I've seen 4 white kids come in.
Mm-hmm. And that's a global pattern too. In every country, almost every country I went to, there was a way of defining a group as other, usually racially, and then finding ways to criminalize them and get them caught up in the criminal justice system so they could be moved to the prisons and ultimately create a labor force. So you're talking about blacks post-slavery in Brazil, blacks and what's called colored in South Africa, even certain ethnic groups in Thailand, the Hill people in Thailand, poor people in Uganda. I mean, the prisons are entirely for poor people. So it's also very, you know, it's not some accidental thing. It's clearly a way to keep certain groups under control in a state of oppression while also serving capitalism's needs, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, creating a labor force for coffee in Brazil, for mining in South Africa, the Aboriginal populations in Australia who actually incarcerate at an even higher number. You know, I never thought such a thing was possible, that you could incarcerate per capita at a higher level of black and brown folks that happens in the U.S. Well, it happens in Australia. Their rates of incarceration of Aboriginal peoples is higher than ours when we talk about certain populations.
Absolutely.
We'll get to Norway.
We're going to have Q&A at the end, my man. Trust me, I'll get to you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I think these stories of success, like Wilson, who she's talking about, and I hope by the end of this, everyone in this room will have an idea of something you can do to get involved and really kind of help move the needle on this issue, because there's so much all of us can do. I have to say, like, I found out very early that being the producer of The Hangover was, in most circles, no one really cared, other than with, like, 15-year-old boys. but to be able to kind of move the needle in this issue, both in the state legislature, et cetera, I got in this through teaching a creative writing class and just sitting with 14, 15, 16-year-old kids that were facing life in prison. And I tell this story all the time, but the first kid I ever met was a 15-year-old that had just been sentenced to 300 years for standing next to a kid older than him that shot a victim in the rear end. Victim was in and out of the hospital in one day, and David Negrete is in prison. I'm going to see him this Thursday. He's in prison for 300 years. And this is the norm. But the other thing that I've seen is, and so obviously on one hand, we need to do something about how we sentence people and how we as a country can give up on a child and basically say, you have no chance of transformation. You have no chance of changing, when everyone in this room who has children knows that they do, part of my language, dumb shit, and they grow up and their brains develop and they become different people. And I've seen through all this time, like, people become different people. One of my first students named Prophet Walker had never been in prison before, 16 years old, good looking, light skinned black kid, was involved with a bunch of friends in a robbery on a train, gets sent into adult prison for 6 years at 16 years old. And in prison, he gets involved in a college program. He earns his AA degree. And then while he's in that prison, he applies to the Loyola Marymount School of Science and Engineering and gets accepted. And he gets his acceptance letter while sitting in a prison dorm. And we created this college dorm. So every inmate in the dorm was a college student. There's now 8,000 inmates in California that are full-time college students.
We need one of those in New York, Scott, so let's talk.
Yeah, and she has an incredible program there. But once he got accepted, then everyone else wasn't happy getting their AA degree, and they all started going for their BA degree. And so the identity change, when you have education, which every research study says reduces recidivism by about 50%, when you have adults in your life, everyone in this room could be a mentor to one person. And when you have a positive, the number one change agent for anyone is having a positive adult in their life that cares. Because so many of the kids I work with, and I know that you work with, don't have that person. And I've really seen education to kind of be a huge game changer. And I wonder if in any of your travels you saw, I know you saw arts and you saw restorative justice and you saw reconciliation, but do you ever see how education played a role? Well, internationally?
Yeah, I mean, I see that every day here on these shores. I started a program at John Jay where I teach called the Prison to College Pipeline, which is a program that allows incarcerated, it's actually, you know, it's young people and adults. I include adults in the conversation about change and the conversation about opportunity. You know, being a grown-up doesn't mean that you're any less deserving of an opportunity and a chance and all of those things. So in that program, students are able to start college on the inside and they're guaranteed a slot in City University of New York when they come home. And what it allows them to do is kind of get the best of both worlds. You get some education on the inside and then you get to continue your journey on the outside, which is the perfect place to start anew and start a new, you know, community. And so I see this with my students. We actually have our first graduate in the program who's graduating with honors in criminal justice come in 2 months, who, you know, I've seen remarkable transformations that happen. But also in many ways, and the students will thank me and, you know, thanks for starting the program and thanks for doing this work. And I feel like you don't have to thank me. You're just getting here what you should have gotten in the first place. So, because it's really about educational access. These are people who were not given educational opportunity. And this is true, again, globally speaking. What you see in the prison systems, I mean, I called them in that reading human detritus. They're like, you know, it's the thing that we consider society's waste and we don't know what to do with. And the bulk of it all over the world are poor people who were not given opportunities. And if you give them the opportunities, things can be otherwise, whether adult or whether child. And that's actually the reason why I don't even use the term rehabilitation, because rehabilitation implies that you were habilitated in the first place. And that is not the case for most people in our prison system and, you know, globally speaking. So the education is doing tremendous things. I mean, there's one other thing that we should mention, and because it should always be mentioned early on in these conversations, and that's the victims that are impacted here. And because we're so often, you know, I think anyone who comes from a restorative justice framework, as I do, knows that conversations about criminal justice always tend to start with the person who did the wrong, the person in the prison, the offender, and how do we punish them and how did we get what they deserve. And newspapers will cover trials and punishment, but not, you know, almost never from a victim-centered perspective. And one thing that is broken about our criminal justice system that isn't talked about enough, and this is, again, something that I saw globally and why I started the journey in Rwanda, a place that is a country full of, I call it a liquidated prison, because post-genocide, either you were a victim or you had been part of the, you know, grand offense, is that our criminal justice system isn't serving the needs of victims very well either. They are not getting what they need from this. And so because we just assume the knee-jerk reaction is every victim is going to be satisfied by a long prison sentence, and that's going to produce healing, and that's going to somehow repair whatever enormous harm was caused to them. And that is simply not the case. It's not a satisfying experience for so many victims in the criminal justice system. So what I went to Rwanda and South Africa in different ways to do was to think about a justice system that is sort of grounded in ideas of restitution, reparation, rather than revenge and punishment and harm. Absolutely. I mean, I think just a quick story about one of my prison to college pipeline students that really hammers this home. I have a student who committed a crime at 17 in which he killed someone, and it was in the kind, he didn't deliberately set out to do it. It was in the context of this, that, and the other. And growing up in the Bronx in hideous circumstances, that is what happened. He is now serving his going on his 24th year for this crime that he committed at 17. He's been shot down by the board 3 times. The 3rd time was last week. And what they said to him is, sorry, the victim wants more time from you. And I thought to myself, well, what is the victim going to get in another 2 years or year that they haven't gotten in 23, 24 years? Because what that says is not, I have enormous empathy for that victim. So does he, which is why he's reached out to the family. He's trying to engage in restorative justice. He carries this deed with him every day of his life, and it weighs his whole spirit down. But you wonder, maybe there's something else that needs to happen here for healing that isn't being found in the context of locking this person, this 17-year-old up for 25 to life.
I went to Rwanda earlier this year as well, and when I read your chapter on Rwanda, you articulated everything I thought and felt. It was it was one of the most horrifying experiences of my life and one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. And that can only be explained by asking Boz to go kind of do the opposite of what we said beforehand. Let's start with Rwanda.
Start with Rwanda.
And read a little passage.
Okay, so just by way of background, when I went to Rwanda, I worked with young genocide. Of course, I learned about the legacy of the post-genocide Gacaca courts and restitution process. But I worked with a group of young genocide survivors between 20 and 25 who were young enough so that they may not have remembered the genocide, but old enough such that their whole lives were impacted by it because most of them were orphaned. And I ended up working with an organization, an NGO called Never Again Rwanda. And these young people wanted to start a program that allowed them to visit prisons as a show of solidarity. And the prisons in Rwanda, about 80% of the prison population is in for the crime of genocide. So essentially you're talking about young people who wanted to go into the prisons where perhaps the people who killed their parents are, and they wanted to do this. And so I worked with them to develop the program and figure out how it would be structured and get permission from the government to start it, which they did. And the leader of the program who I worked closely with, his name is Santos. So this is the day of our first visit to the prison. Inside the annex, nearly 100 prisoners sit serenely on long wooden benches, some looking as young as 20 and others well past middle age. We sit on benches directly facing them. Eric takes the microphone and offers a greeting filled with murakoses, thank yous. Next comes singing and clapping. One curly-haired, sweet-faced corrections officer, handsome in his khaki uniform, introduces himself to me as Rolf and appoints himself my translator. He murmurs in my ear. We come because of love, Santos announces. Applause. Today we will talk with you about current events. We will discuss the topic of gender. What is the meaning of equal rights? From there, lively dialogue erupts. Students take turns at the mic, but Santos is clearly the leader and very much in his element. I marvel at the way he's abruptly transformed from shy and gawky to buoyant and garrulous, a teacher and a leader. Should the nation be run by a woman, Santos asks. Never, calls one prisoner. Our prison used to be run by a woman. Now it is run by a man, and it is far better. Women are too subject to moods to run a country, calls another prisoner. Howls of disagreement erupt from all sides. The students and prisoners break off into groups to debate the issue further. Where is your gun? I ask Rolf, the corrections officer. We do not carry guns, comes the reply. There is almost no violence here. Order is maintained by a prisoner-run government led by a capita general and an array of capitas under him who govern individual blocks. Rolf laughs as he tells me that one prison has a block, Texas, so named because it's occupied by wealthier prisoners. The capita in charge of security is called the commissaire, and there's little need for the corrections officers to even enter the prison. Elections are held regularly. Most capitas are genocidaires and highly educated. Most genocidaires, after all, were highly educated. I cannot lie. I do look at the men in prison uniforms and think skulls. Almost a million of them. Corpses, rape, machetes, murder. These men did all of that. And yet here they are looking like human beings, being warm and gregarious with the survivors of their atrocities, who are in turn kind and gracious beyond measure. Is such a thing really possible? My mind reels, and so does my heart. American prisons are harsh, isn't it? Rolf asks. I nod. And I hear that they have no internet connection, yes? How can that be? I don't know how it can be, Rolf, but indeed it is. Rolf gapes at this. He explains that there's a prison economy in which services like laundry and goods are for sale. Most prisoners have jobs on the outside and keep 10% of their pay. They're permitted to go on work leave, I ask, surprised. Of course. Rolf gives me a silly Mzungu stare. Mzungu is a white person. Here we play football with them. There is no difference between these prisoners and us. The only difference is, how do you say? He fingers his uniform, the cloth. But I cannot resist asking, aren't some corrections officers, aren't they survivors? Isn't it hard for them to be here, you know, to play football with the genocidaires? A second stare. No, says Rolf firmly. There is a word called, how do you say, forgiveness. Silly Mzungu me. Do not take me for naive. The cynical New Yorker in me looked hard for the flaws in this Rwandan facade, searched for the greedy, self-interested motives lurking beneath the peace agenda. I struggled to find them. There is a word called forgiveness. Indeed, if there were cracks in the facade, even if there did exist persistent social divisions, ways in which the gachacha system had failed, excessive government censorship, the ease with which this mantra, forgiveness, rolls off every Rwandan's tongue, the way it has firmly ensconced itself as the crown jewel of this country's national narrative, this was striking. Lip service has value. Say forgiveness often enough, and eventually behavioral psychology kicks in and divine actions follow. Preach punishment and watch bloody hell break loose. The prisoners and students reconvene to present their group's findings. There is more speechifying, handshaking, and laughter. We are out of time before I know it. We have much to learn from you, Rolf declares as we say goodbye, muttering something about high-tech security measures and official prison procedures. But I hope you all also have something to learn from us. It's a grand understatement. As we file out of the prison through throngs of men in uniform who pass us unperturbed, one student hugs me and slings her arm through mine. She is giddy. The visit has gone better than expected, and she cannot wait for the next one. She wishes there was more time with the imprisoned men, who were so bright and interesting with many good ideas. The visit was, like, amazing, another student beaming says during the ride back. When we meet those guys, they were very, very happy. As we were discussing in groups, their ideas were really amazing. They are bright. I am very excited to meet those guys. They show us that they have new things to teach us. Add Santos when we reach the office. We have to make a better world. This is part of peace building, making sure that these guys who are in prison, they are human beings like others. They will come home, and we will all live in peace. So that, and I actually then say, I couldn't even believe that Santos was real, to be honest. The things that he has lived through, he's an orphan of genocide, and he was he who led, he's still leading this program in Rwanda, it's called the Prison Visiting Project. And, you know, it's, I think in places when, and I think you can see global examples of this, where you can, I went into Rwanda believing in restorative justice in theory and believing in so much of this ethos of, and again, I don't even say forgiveness, I say reparations and restitution. It's about actions. It's not just, I'm sorry, oops, right? You have to set up a program, but which Rwanda did. There were paybacks, there were systems of restitution. But to see it enacted and to see what people are capable of is really evidence of the fact, you know, I think ultimately I saw the best and worst of humanity on this trip. And the best of humanity is capable of a lot. And we do not give the public credit for that reality.
Yeah, I met, when I was in Rwanda, I met a woman who was probably in her 60s at this point, whose entire family, her kids, her husband, everyone was slaughtered during the genocide. And when she went to the courts, the man asked for forgiveness. And again, I don't even think I could do this. But she decided that the punishment for him would be a few years in a work camp. And then for him to come home back to the small village that they lived in to be of service to her for the rest of his life. And they now live next to each other. Mm-hmm. And she said, before the court hearing happened, where courts, the whole village shows up to decide what happens. And if the person really is remorseful and asks for forgiveness, that's what usually happens. And she said, I had so much hatred in my heart. I woke up with the heaviest heart every day. And the more he went to this work camp and the more I visited him and the more I got to know him and the more I saw that his remorse was real, the easier it got for me. And now it is so easy. I live such a good life. He's here. He helps me in everything. He helps me get my groceries. He helps me plant my garden. He helps me do all this. And this is what's happening on a huge scale in Rwanda. And you see us in this country, which is just like punish, 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 punish. And the victim never gets any healing. They're just as angry 25 years later when they show up to a parole hearing. By the way, rightfully so. It's just unbelievable. When I was in Rwanda, the people are African and the prisoners are African. And they say, these are Rwandans. They are us. They are our community. We must make them better. So when they come out, they're better. Then I went to Germany, and the German people are white and European, and the prisoners are white and European. And they say the German Constitution says the whole purpose of the system is for resocialization and rehabilitation. They're Germans. We must make them better. They will be our neighbors. And in the United States, 95% of the people in prison are going to be our neighbors. They're going to live right next door to many of us. And the first line of our penal code in California is the purpose of prison is punishment. The exact opposite of Rwanda, the exact opposite of Germany.
And yet we're schizophrenic on it because we still call it a Department of Corrections. And here in California, you added the extra R to imply rehabilitation. So I actually think that that's the heart of the problem, is that we talk out of both sides of our mouth on the issue.
Absolutely. And the crazy thing about this issue is all the data and evidence shows you exactly what works. Mentoring works. Education works. Connections to employment, training, and employment when someone comes out works. Therapy for trauma works. All of this stuff, housing, providing safe and stable housing so someone doesn't have to be released right back into the same war zone they came out of, works. All these things work. And I read in your book about your visit to Brazil, and we know one thing that does not work. All the evidence points to solitary confinement being one of the most damaging things to a human being. And I'll give a little bit of a California overtone here, and then I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about Brazil and then maybe read a segment. The week after I went to Rwanda, I went to Pelican Bay. And she was saying Pelican Bay State Prison, the guy that called me when we were at dinner at Cafe Pino, that's in Northern California, almost in Oregon, and it's where we've had men locked up in solitary confinement, 23 hours a day, some up to 40 years. And when I went to Pelican Bay for my first time, we had passed a law called Senate Bill 260 in 2013, where anyone who committed their crime as a juvenile, like the kid David Negrete I told you about, they got 300 years, had the chance of a parole hearing after 15, 20, or 25 years. So people that thought they were going to die in prison for a crime they committed as a juvenile were now told that they were going to be able to get a parole hearing. And by the way, bipartisan vote, my first two letters of support were from Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist, as well as 1,000 other progressive organizations on the planet. 9 Republicans voted yes on the bill. Jerry Brown signed it on the second day it was on his desk. And about 19,000 people in prison are affected by it who thought they were going to die there and now get the chance to come home. So David Negrete, the kid who got 300 years, has a parole hearing in 4 years now because of this bill. Thank you. But when we went up to Pelican Bay, we talked to 112 guys in the SHU. And one of the first guys I saw was a 60-ish-year-old man who committed his crime at 15 years old and had been in the SHU for 36 years. And the SHU is a security housing unit, solitary confinement, meaning you're in your cell for 23 hours a day, and the 1 hour you're not in your cell, they buzz your cell door open, you walk out, you walk into a concrete recreation yard by yourself, the door closes, and now you're in a concrete box where you can throw the handball against the wall by yourself or do some pull-ups on the dip bar. But it's so diabolical that they didn't want them to be able to see the sky or the sun. So they put these slits in so you couldn't see the sky and you couldn't see the sun, but you got one slit of natural sunlight. And this is how these folks, and And a lot of the folks, probably 800 of the 1,100 people in the Pelican Bay SHU, were in there for what's called a validation, meaning they committed no violence, but the system said they were in some way associated with a prison gang, and they put them in the SHU, and your only way out of the SHU if you're validated as an associate, even not even a member, an associate of a prison gang, is to either snitch or die. If you tell on the whole gang, then your whole family could be killed. So that's not an option for many people. So your only other option was die until a lawsuit this year, and now they're emptying the SHU. Mm-hmm. But the man I saw there to talk about the juvenile parole bill, he never thought he was going to get out. I'm now being told him after he's done 40 years that he's going to go to the parole board next year. And this old man in between the cage that we're talking in, cage, starts crying. And he sticks his little finger through the hole in the cage, and I stick my finger, and we shook pinkies. And he said, "You're the first person I've touched in 36 years. First person, honest to God. So this was my Pelican Bay experience, and I've met absolutely beautiful people in there that got college degrees in the SHU that are now out because of the lawsuit and now going to the parole board. And I actually, my intern at my office two blocks away from here, who's the greatest intern I could have ever imagined, did 18 years in the Pelican Bay SHU. And as soon as he was released, we hired him. And he's fantastic. So tell us a little bit about Brazil.
That practice, we invented that. We, meaning America. We created the first solitary confinement prison at Eastern State Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. And the concept of solitary, by the way, is based on one of the original concepts of prison as a penitentiary from penitence. They thought if you create these monastery-like settings and you put everybody in their little cells and you give them a Bible, then they'll repent and they'll come out much better. So that's the theory on which solitary confinement, which is now widely used as a practice around the globe. Supermaxes are the most glaring examples of them. And we, America, developed the Supermax model then, which is all solitary units in the 1980s. And various countries followed suit, so that now you have versions of supermaxes around the world in lots of countries. And I went to Brazil to look at the rising number of federal supermax prisons that are enormously expensive to build, where you have people in prison for in their cells for 22 hours a day. And I'll read you a little bit of what my experience was there. It's an atrocious place where you're basically witnessing people going mad right before your eyes. And I went through, I had the chance to talk to some people, and one of them was somebody named Carlos, who I had the same interview experience, where you talk to someone through a tiny little slat in a cell, and you try to hope that there's a human being there. En route to cell block Charlie, as the agent calls it, I finally hear a sound of life, muffled calls from the double-tiered wards echoing through labyrinthine hallways. Prisoners exist in the heart of this maze, and that term is apt, since its vestibules and courtyards have been designed to disorient. Though he lived to be in the same cell 10 weary years, Alexis de Tocqueville once wrote of the American prisoner in solitary, he has no means of knowing, down to the very last hour, in what part of the building it is situated. I am steered to a cell where a hinge slat on the dense metal door creaks open. I peer through. Eyes greet me. They belong to Carlos. He stands at attention in his pristine pint-sized cell, as if in a lineup. Bon dia, Andre says. Those eyes. Windows to a grief-stricken soul. It's the most bizarre, unsettling conversation, is it an interview, I've ever conducted. I speak through a hole in a safe-like door, Andre whispering hasty translation for me, and I'm surrounded by eavesdropping ears, interred behind neighboring iron doors. Carlos, 41, is from a notorious Rio favela. These are essentially self-contained slums erected on vacant land by a growing class of urban poor during the 1980s, often compared to the garrison communities of Kingston, Jamaica, or the townships of South Africa. They lack basic social services and are lorded over by gangs. Carlos has spent 16 years in prison on homicide, gun possession, forgery, and hijacking charges, and has lived in Catanduvas, the solitary unit, for 2 years and 8 months after being transferred from the state system. But Mara, I asked, spinning around, isn't there a 360-day limit to a prisoner's stay in solitary here, after which he's meant to be transferred back to the state? I could have sworn the director told me as much. Most cases, yes, but not always. It depends. The rule changes. Carlos straightens out a wrinkle in his sky blue t-shirt, which has Interno printed across it, which I read as Inferno. He explains that he has a 98-year sentence, but no one actually serves more than 30 years in Brazil. Good that our country is not like the USA, he quips. Carlos unfastens three photos from his wall and proudly displays his five children, aged 5 to 23, and a 7-year-old grandson. Like most of the men at Catanduvas, he's had no in-person visits since his arrival. His family cannot afford to fly here. They can barely afford the bus fare from the favela to the virtual prison visit center in Rio, where families using a Skype-like system log on to see their incarcerated loved ones. Once, after Carlos painted the entire prison, the director paid his family's transportation fees to the virtual visit center. It cost about $20, but they've made just three more trips there since. How can I rehabilitate without family, he asks. I dream nightmares of being abandoned by my family, by my children. I wake up in panic with this kind of dream, anxious with fear. I want the chance to give them an example of how I made a mistake, yes, but I learned from my own mistakes, from the mistakes of others. I learned human beings deserve a second chance, an opportunity to show themselves so everybody will see that person has changed. Carlos pauses and swallows hard. 22 hours inside this cell, it is just hell. My days are hell, to tell you the truth. I am suffocated. I am dead. There is nothing else to say. Buried, but alive still. There is more to say, of course, but we talk Dostoevsky instead. Carlos participates in rehabilitation through reading, which Mara had explained to me. It was started in 2009 by a controversial federal judge who essentially told prison officials that since there was no money for programs, let the prisoners read books. Like the Supermax, it has American precedents, such as Changing Lives Through Literature, a Massachusetts-based bibliotherapy program offering alternative probation options via literature classes. Good stories, the program's website explains, provoke us to feel compassion for fictional characters, each other, and ourselves. By stepping into another's shoes, it goes on, people in prison can process their emotional struggles without confessing. Lifting a well-worn copy of Crime y Castigo, Crime and Punishment, from his shelf, Carlos delivers his analysis. Crime brings consequences to family. Think before you act. This is the novel's essence. The main character, too, he confesses. Guilt eats him alive. He murdered and stole, and he cannot go on. He is tortured in his mind. Impossible to do wrong and not feel guilt. Do you feel guilt, Carlos? I ask. Every day of my life, I am a living error, a walking mistake. Do you imagine how this feels, to be a living error and only an error? But even in hell, I am hopeful. I am almost 42 now, but my life has not ended. I want to go to university, study theology and psychology. I'm writing a book, too. It's titled The Hikers of the Deep Fall. The hikers are you and me who look inside and see that as human beings, our job is to grab the rope and climb upward, never seeing the long fall. Two men in white wheel a metal cart down the hallway, passing small plates of pills through the slats in each cell. 80% of the men locked up here are on medication. I only took them when I first came here, yes, Carlos says, to sleep, pills, and for anxiety, depression. To be alone all of these hours, impossible, I am afraid. The agent seals the slat on Carlos's door, and without a goodbye, he vanishes. Time is up. So most of the people, I mean, we haven't even broached on the whole subject of mental illness in prisons, but there's an inordinate high percentage of people who are mentally ill in our prison system. But I think the most terrifying thing of the many terrifying things in that Brazilian prison is that almost everyone in there was not on medication before they went in there. They're on medication now. And that's, so what we are doing is literally driving people mad. And many of the people in there, again, were in for small infractions. It's supposedly the worst of the worst. But in fact, one of the really young people, I think he was about 20 years old, was in there because he spit on the prosecutor's face, which given the legal system in Brazil for poor people of color, it was highly appropriate.
Yeah.
But I think the thing also that's key to remember, and of all the countries that I went to, Brazil and South Africa, I think haunted me the most because they are absolute grotesque mirrors of us in that they are places where inequality is produced by society, tolerated in favelas and townships, and then dealt with, you know, the form of welfare is prison. And so it's essentially you're manufacturing criminals by tolerating these conditions inside these slums, and then you're punishing people as a kind of grand human scapegoat. And everything that I heard working with gang members in South Africa, talking to people in prison in Brazil, was basically the level of violence and addiction that is produced by communities that we then, you know, go and again scapegoat people for is a grotesque exaggeration of exactly what happens in our communities here in LA, in New York, wherever.
So we're going to turn it over to you guys for some questions and answers in less than 5 minutes. I just want to hit two more quick topics because I know everyone's wondering how to get involved in some way. I'd love to talk a little bit about kind of what you learned in terms of your visit to Singapore and what they do for employment for folks coming out. Obviously, you can only imagine how difficult it is for someone to get a job when they get out. I've hired many. I had three young men who had gotten out work on The Hangover as prop assistants, set dressing, et cetera. And they worked so hard. They hustled so much harder than everyone else that by the end of the film, they were in the union and their bosses took them onto every film, TV show. They're all making $125,000 a year or more now. They're in the unions. And now we have of our 270 ARC members that are part of my organization who are all formerly incarcerated, probably about 15 who are working full-time in the entertainment business, and then others. We have doctors, we have lawyers, we have architects, engineers, electricians, plumbers, firefighters, EMTs. And you'll find that this group of people are so hungry because of some of the stuff they've done in their life and wanting to make it right, that they will work so much harder and be so much more honest and moral than so many of the folks that many of us have hired before. And I found that to be very true. Give us a quick snapshot of Singapore, and then I want to move on to one other thing.
Okay. Reentry is another prison criminal justice term that I hate, because reentry implies, oh, just leave the room, come back, reenter. It's real easy, right? And of course, that completely belittles how impossible that task is, as you just described, to find you're not allowed to live anywhere, no one will hire you, you're not eligible for social services. I mean, it's completely outrageous. I actually went to Singapore. When we think of Singapore, you probably think of caning, draconian punishments, certainly very evil things that happen in terms of drug punishments for drug offenses, capital punishment for even small amounts of drugs. But I went there to look at a reentry program that I had heard about and found really fascinating. And it's called the Yellow Ribbon Project. And essentially what it does is it finds, they have a 98% rate in finding people coming home from prison jobs in the in various industries. It's quite amazing. They're really committed to helping people find jobs and helping people stay there. And what they also have, and this is, I think, relevant to all of us because it relates to kind of word of mouth and public consciousness, they have an ad campaign. They have a whole ad campaign around promoting the acceptance of formerly incarcerated people. So they'll have TV ads and print ads. The yellow ribbons are worn, you know, I'd walk into a taxi in Singapore and there's a yellow ribbon there to signify I support formerly incarcerated people, I hire formerly incarcerated people. So, I mean, I think that's important on so many levels in terms of what you just mentioned. Hiring practices, we need to push for changes in hiring practices. What's being called the ban the box movement is really important so that people don't have to immediately identify themselves and then be overtly discriminated against in ways that employers are embarrassed to talk about their discrimination when it comes to race and gender, but they are overt about their discrimination against this particular group of people. But also the power of changing consciousness, getting people to think about this population differently, not as, and I love your description because it's like, they're not, this is not a liability that needs to be dealt with. This is a set of people that bring gifts and, I mean, as you can tell from the pieces that I read, incredible intelligence and thoughtfulness and life experience to the table. And so it's tremendously important. There's a nefarious side to the whole Singaporean effort as well, but you'll have to read the book to find that.
Yeah. There's great employers. Cheesecake Factory has hired a bunch of our guys and girls. Starbucks has, and a bunch of other smaller businesses have as well. And we're actually running a tax credit bill in the legislature this year to give a tax credit to businesses that are hiring formerly incarcerated people.
Yes. We have that in New York, but it's so small as to be negligible.
We won't make that mistake. The last two things I want to tell you, and then we're going to turn it over for questions and answers. On the ballot in November, when you have the decision of Donald Trump versus whoever, will be, to answer your question, two ballot measures around the death penalty. One, to eliminate the death penalty and resentence everybody to life without parole, meaning they still will die in prison, but they're not going to be put to death. And they will be able to work in prison and pay restitution to their victims the entire time. The other measure is written by the district attorneys, and it's actually a measure to speed up executions. And they've called it something along the lines of the Death Penalty Reform and Rehabilitation Act. So when you read the death penalty reform, just read the small print. So when you see the title, you aren't confused. It's a busy ballot. There's going to be marijuana legalization. There's going to be gun control. And if you haven't heard, Governor Brown has admitted that in the 1970s, when he was governor the first time, he created the system of mass incarceration by signing the determinate sentencing law, which he thought was the right thing to do back then. And I will say, I've been working very closely with him. He's probably the best governor we've had on this issue in 100 years. And he has said over and over in the media that he made a mistake and he wants to correct it. So on the ballot, you're going to have the Public Safety and Rehabilitation Act, that one will stop the practice of trying most juveniles as adults and instead putting them into rehabilitative systems of therapy and education. Number two, it will give nonviolent people in prison the chance to go to the parole board after they've served the time for their offense and before they've had to do an additional 100 years for all these enhancements that get put on them. And the third piece is that it actually will incentivize rehabilitation with folks in prison will be able to earn a few months to a year off their sentence by doing things that we know rehabilitate them. Education programs, college programs, anger management programs, drug programs, therapy, et cetera. I really believe it's an incredible initiative that gives hope to people inside, that encourages people to change, to transform, to become better people, to redeem themselves. And that will likely be on the ballot, but the district attorneys have sued the governor to stop it from going on the ballot, and the California Supreme Court is considering that right now. So that's where we are. That is what you can do, and we are now going to open it up for questions. So I see...
Well, you've got to give the Norway joke.
All right.
One right over here.
We're gonna start right here. We got you soon. Don't worry. Coming your way. Go on.
We'll come back to you.
We're coming to you. There's a microphone.
I promise we'll talk Norway.
I appreciate the comments that y'all made in the presentation, especially the comment in the beginning about colonization and kind of this being a kind of our export along with war and imperialism and all that. One of the things that the author said how society produces this inequality and people are then punished for it. I was wondering if you could elaborate more on the concept, which a lot of prison abolitionists would say is that our society is actually animated by the inequality, right? Like society is made possible by this racial, gendered, and class inequality that exists today. So really the problem is our conception of civil society, right? And then the other question for both of y'all is, how do y'all feel as far as your positionalities, right? Like, as folks that I'm assuming, because y'all didn't mention it, who are not intimately touched by the prison system like those folks that y'all are working with. You know what I mean? Like, and of course, y'all work with it, so y'all intimately touched, but mm-hmm. like your family, and you don't come from communities that have been historically targeted, right, by that. So thank you.
Great question. So for one, I could have let you keep going with the first comment because you were making, you know, really, really important points. But certainly our society is built on the backs of inequality. It always has been. And we know that historically prison systems come out, they follow slavery again, you know, and have been found. We know this has become a popularized notion in America thanks to the book The New Jim Crow, which put the paradigm in a way that everyone could see it. But this idea of taking certain populations and finding a way to re-enslave them is actually something that happened post-colonialism and post-slavery all over the world. And our system relies on that. And it is not some like little, you know, crazy conspiracy theory. It's just a flat out reality. And I'm glad you also invoked the word abolition, because I definitely identify as a prison abolitionist. I don't think that prisons are an effective, or, you know, they're not effective morally, socially, economically, in any respect. That does not mean, and I think one should understand that to be a prison abolitionist doesn't mean that you think that you don't think there are people in the world who are not fit for society, who will do harm to others. They exist. The question is what we do with them and how we keep them apart and what sort of institution. And it also means recognizing that that is not the bulk of our criminal justice system, neither here nor globally speaking. And you can't design a system for the Charles Mansons. Because that's not what we're really dealing with overall. So abolitionism is a really important part of the conversation. And then for my part on positionality, and this is something I thought about every second. I mean, I think about it constantly here. I think about it every second when I'm in prisons around the world as a foreigner, as a white person, as a woman, as an American, with all the sets of privileges that accompanies me. And it's all over the book, my awareness of that and my struggle with that. But I think the thing to remember is that, I mean, I started working in prisons when I started going into them and engaging in real educational work with the people inside them about a dozen years ago, 12, 13 years ago. And I felt like, you know, I'm a believer in communities that can transcend things like you're my family, or you're the same race as me, or you're the same gender as me. I mean, we're in this together. We're part of the humanity. And I, you know, so for me, it was about recognizing that you don't have to be like someone else in order to care about them. You don't have to be intimately impacted. I haven't had family members incarcerated, right? I don't, and I myself have not been incarcerated. Now I have, my world is populated by people who are either incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. But that's the point to me, is that you can transcend it. And then, I mean, we're gonna talk about Norway in a second, but one of the things that people say about Norway when they hear about some of its progressiveness is, oh, but that's, you know, that's a country that's so homogenous. Everybody is all white, and so it's easier for people to care. What a terrible statement about humanity that is, that you can only care if it's the same, you know, if it's the same color. Like, that's, again, setting our expectations of what humanity is capable of in terms of caring and justice really, really low.
So we have 10 minutes, so I'm going to ask everyone to keep their questions to 15 seconds, and we'll keep our responses to 30 seconds, and hopefully we'll get a bunch of questions. My man right here. He's about to pull a chair.
Did you ever eat any of the food?
After all that, yes.
After all that, it's about the food.
El Chapo just got arrested. They're criminalizing the drugs right here in downtown LA. We have people smoking pot nowadays. It's just a common thing to smell pot nowadays. Now, growing up in the '60s, being a hippie and all that, now everybody's smoking chronic.
What's the question?
What do you think about, you know, female incarceration? Regarding all we talked about was, I think, is male.
Got it.
Okay, so good question. I went
the
to
the food and then female.
Well, I did eat. Yes, I have eaten the food in many prisons around the world, and it is certainly better some places than others, as you would expect, right? But I went to women's prisons in Thailand where I worked with the Princess of Thailand's initiative. And what I saw there was, again, an exaggerated version of what we have in this country, which is that the bulk of women are incarcerated because they were asked by a man to carry drugs, they were implicated. They're basically hapless foot soldiers in a larger drug trade.
This is an absolutely true statement.
Yes, and particularly vulnerable, women are particularly vulnerable to this, and particularly in Thailand, where if your boyfriend or husband says to you, take this package somewhere, you don't say no. So they were, you know, so that was, and then you end up with draconian sentences.
Next question.
To what extent in your travels did you discover that a country's religious or tribal traditions affected how they incarcerated their populations in prison?
That was the perfect example of a question right there. That was 10 seconds with a question mark.
Religious traditions deeply inform much of the work. And in fact, it was present in almost every, certainly with restorative justice in South Africa. Much of the restorative justice work that's happening globally is tied to Christian organizations. That is not always the case. And it wasn't the case in Rwanda, where it's actually tied to pre-colonial traditions. I mean, restorative justice has roots in many ethnic groups in Africa, including many of the groups in Rwanda. So there is certainly an intense religious presence that usually pushes toward the progressive, but also keeps people in kind of traditional modes of not questioning things that I've seen quite a bit. And if we had time, I'd go into that in more detail in different countries.
Next question, right over here.
Although the systems you have described are bad enough, what do you think about the systems such as Iran and North Korea?
You know, what can I say, right? It's a bad situation, globally speaking. And I also didn't talk about Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Middle East isn't present, and we're talking about levels of execution that are unknown to us. Talk about lack of transparency. But I think the lack of transparency is probably the most frightening thing. Again, as I read in the passage in the beginning, how can we endorse a justice system if we don't even know what it's doing? And so hiding prisons away is utterly ludicrous, right? We should be able to see what we are sending people to and what we are doing. And the two countries you mentioned, are, along with Saudi, are probably the most prominent examples of a justice system that's hidden.
We have time for two or three more.
I want to thank you both for shedding light on this. I've recently been rocked out of my own complacency by interacting with this a little too close for comfort. A dear friend of mine was arrested on false charges and is in solitary in Men's Central Jail, hoarding his food for the days they don't feed him, told to take his drinking water out of the back of the toilet, denied medical care, and is now most likely going to take a plea bargain and admit to a crime he didn't commit and face deportation rather than continue what could be a long sentence in a prison jail less than a mile from here.
Get me his name and his number, and I'll see him this weekend in the jail.
Lovely, thank you.
Yeah.
I sent a chaplain to him, and the chaplain hit on him. So even the places where I think I'm going to get help, there is none. But my question is, shy of voting at the, you know, using your vote, when I've approached other district attorneys, they all say, yeah, well, that's what it is. That's just, there's a expectation, you know, a very low bar expectation of that's what we're dealing with. Where do you go? Who do you talk to? Where are the groups that can actually do something? Because just my own humanity, I'm so challenged by a feeling of helplessness.
Do you mean do something in terms of the time he's facing or the conditions inside or everything?
Are there advocacy groups that can get involved in individual cases? His case may be helped, may not be helped, but I can no longer stand by. We expect, you know, we hear these things about a Turkish prison or Guantanamo Bay, but I'm shocked at my own naivete that this is going on in my own community and the horror of that. And where do we go to get involved?
Come to us. Okay. We do a lot of policy change, and we also do a lot of working with folks when they come home. So whether it's the direct service piece or mentoring, If you go to www.arc-ca.org, you can get involved in kind of the efforts with people coming home and helping them get back on track. But also a lot of the policy change things we're doing, we're partnered with the governor in the ballot measure. We're running a lot of our own legislation. We're running our seventh bill in the legislature this year. So all of it could help. And we have one of the best DAs in the state. And that's not saying much because they're awful for the most part.
Yes.
But Jackie Lacey has done some real reforms. I've seen her to be a decent person, and she's made the right decision in many cases. So well, I'm happy to talk to you about it. And I'll definitely,
thank
if you,
you
get him the information, I'll see him this weekend.
Appreciate it.
A couple
it.
More
thank
questions?
You.
Right here.
Hi, I was wondering, with $50 billion a year, with $50 billion a year, are there people who are really benefiting from this financially, and is that part of the problem?
You should, if you want to go to the academy and become a prison guard, it pays about $100,000 a year.
So when we talk about benefiting and economically benefiting, it's happening in all kinds of complicated ways, some more flagrant than others, right? The most flagrant example is the private prison industry. And certainly we know the private prison industry is making billions off of this and also and controlling our legislature around these issues in terrifying ways. But it's important to recognize that the state system, you know, I mean, only about 7% of people in prison in the state system are in private prisons. The federal system's larger, and immigration is now the booming industry.
Yeah.
For private prisons. But the state system is implicated, there's money-making schemes happening across the board. I know in California, I don't know if it's still the case, but it used to be that all the desks at the University of California schools were made in prisons. There's DMV call centers that are in prisons. Whole Foods tilapia is coming from prisons. Like, so there's all manner of ways that the industry is tied in. So it's not a matter of like, I mean, one person becoming a billionaire per se. It's a matter of how enmeshed capitalism is to prison. And capitalism is also tied in ideologically to prison. You know, it was born, capitalism and the prison system were born around the same time. And prisons were basically conceived of as like factories for human beings. Factories for rehabilitation. And that's how they operate.
Never been so happy that I hate tilapia. next question. Two more. Great.
Hi. My question is, I have school psychologist background, and I've been testing students for a long time. And to be proactive, you know, with the prison, I'm looking at from elementary to high school. Now, what happens is that we have a lot of Latinos and African Americans that are labeled early. Just because our cognitive and our academic tests have demonstrated, quote unquote, you know, most Latinos are African Americans, they might not have a spatula at home. So when they have a test and they mm-hmm. see a test and mm-hmm. they see the picture, they say, what is that? They do not know what it is. So therefore, they get labeled. And so what happens is they're growing through the system as, oh, you're dumb, you're stupid. So when they get into high school, most of the girls get pregnant or drop out. You know, we have dropouts. Then therefore, crime develops in the neighborhood or in the system.
Great point. The question.
I'm going to the question. The question is... how to be more proactive at a young age. You're talking about the prisons, true enough, but we have to catch this at an early age. You guys talking about all these things that we can do. I work in high school right now, and we need to catch these students early, mm-hmm. you know, before they get in prison, how to be more proactive to help our students and help mm-hmm. our society, because we have to live amongst these people.
So I couldn't agree more. You're describing the school-to-prison pipeline. And when I started the prison-to-college pipeline, obviously, it was a play on that. How do we reverse that flow? But I think what your comment and your question speaks to is the fact that criminal justice reform, prison reform doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's about creating a whole system, you know, that's the before, the during, and the after, so that we need to stop producing communities that, you know, are funneling the flow into the prison system. We need to deal with the conditions within the system when people are incarcerated and ultimately, you know, revolutionize how that goes on. And then we need to deal with the after piece. So you can't talk about, You can't talk about prison reform without talking about education reform. You can't talk about it without talking about health care reform, right? Again, meant the issue of mental illness. So what it points to is that what we need is, you know, a think tank that consists of people doing this work across the board, including people like you.
Last question. Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, I'm sorry I relate. You may have touched on this already. How do you break down the investment part of a prison industrial complex? Maybe you've already said something, but I didn't hear. How do you change that? Because if you have a tremendous incentive for investment and the stock market and everything, how are you going to change that and get the money out of prison industrial complex? Thank you.
Yeah, I was waiting to hear Bernie Sanders explain that when he talked about abolishing the private prison industry. Oh, well, you made it to the right spot. No, no, I'm kidding. How do you do it? That's an enormous question. And I'm not sure I have the answer to that. But for one, I think if we're going to, I mean, if we're going to allow privatization at all, which I don't think we should altogether, you have to dismantle these, you know, and how we do that is a problem for economists to figure out. But for one, the one thing we can do to start is we need legislation that controls the amount of lobbying power that these companies have. It is simply unacceptable that they have that level of control. And we need to stop even, you know, I think we can start by tinkering with even how the measurements are held for how the success is defined, beds being filled. Recidivism rates are almost beside the point when we talk about the success of a private prison industry, and yet we're giving them enormous power. So I think you kind of start with the tinkering and take it from there. I should say that in Australia, which is where I worked in the private prisons, I struggled deeply with the fact that the two private prisons that I worked in, I taught an autobiography writing class in one, the other one I just visited and met with some of the, it was for young people, for young men aged 18 to 24, were enormously progressive places for prisons. And especially the one for young men. It was for 18 to 24-year-olds. It was an open prison. They were able to come and go, engage in community work. It was run on restorative justice. It was like a campus, basically. And I think the most distressing thing was to see, and what they told me again and again was, because we're private industry, we can do more with innovation. So if we think about something like that, you know, then maybe that can start dismantling.
Let's give it up for Boz.
Thank you. Scott.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.